Good morning. Today is Friday, August 19th, 2022. The time is 9:59 a.m. I now call the meeting of the Finance Commission to order pursuant to Chapter 551 of the Government Code. At this time, I'd like to thank Dr. Robin Armstrong for his service to the Finance Commission. He has termed out and went off to another opportunity within the state government. And so we certainly appreciate Robin and all he did during his time here. But we'd like to welcome our newest member, Mr. Marty Green, to the Finance Commission. He is the principal and attorney in charge for Polanski, Beidel, and Green. He has practiced law for over 30 years with a focus on the financial services and consumer credit arenas, including with the Dallas's offices of Thompson and Knight and Baker Botts. In addition, he's a member of the State Bar of Texas and the Dallas Bar Association, and a volunteer for the Habitat for Humanity. Mr. Green received his Bachelor of Arts from Southern Utah University and a JD from the University of Texas Law School. So, Marty, thank you so much for joining us. We look forward to working with you and being the newest member. You didn't have to bring donuts this morning. You might have the fortune to do that next time. It's part of your hazing process.
I appreciate that. Thank you very much.
Also, I've been contacted by Commissioners Morris and Borchoff that they have not are able to attend today, and I would request that their absences be excused. In accordance to the Finance Code 11.103, the commission members will take a vote to either accept or deny this request. All in favor of excusing the absences, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, say nay. The ayes have it, and the absences are excused. Commissioner Cooper, will you do a roll call?
Yes, for the record, Philip Holt.
Present.
Bob Barkoff. Hector Cerner.
Present.
Marty Green.
Present.
Will Lucas.
Present.
Cliff McCauley.
Here.
Sharon McCormick.
Here.
Rosie Morris. Absent. Laura Warren.
Here.
Vince Puente.
Yes, sir.
Debbie Scanlon.
Present.
We have a quorum.
Thank you. Welcome to the public for being here. It's good to see everybody this morning. If there's anyone wishing to address the commission during the public comment, you will need a complete a witness affidavit form and bring it up front. Public comments on non-agenda items are limited to 5 minutes and agenda items to 10 minutes. Any comments relating to the rule may be made at the time of the rule discussion. In accordance with the Finance Commission's policy on public testimony, public comments are not allowed on the agenda items to the final rule adoptions except under the majority vote of the commission, in which the comments are limited just to 2 minutes. I don't think we have anybody for the general session, so we will move on. Item five, the audit committee report. Chairman Scanlon.
Yes. The audit committee would like to make a motion that the Finance Commission approve the agency's 2022 third quarter investment officer reports.
Coming upon the recommendation of the audit committee, no second is needed. Members, any discussion? All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Ayes have it, the motion passes.
The audit committee would like to make a motion that the Finance Commission approve the readoption of the investment policies as amended for the Office of Consumer Credit Commissioner, Department of Savings and Mortgage Lending, and the Texas Department of Banking.
Coming upon the recommendation of the audit committee, no second is needed. So any discussion, members? Seeing none, all in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Ayes have it, the motion passes.
The audit committee would like to make a motion that the Finance Commission approve the agency's 2022 third quarter financial statements.
Having upon the recommendation of the audit committee, no second is needed. Any discussion, members? All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Ayes have it. The motion carries.
The audit committee would like to make a motion that the Finance Commission approve the Office of Consumer Credit Commissioner's fiscal year 2023 operating budget.
Coming upon the recommendation of the audit committee, no second is needed. Any discussion, members? This is the critical part that we really wanted y'all to be a part of. So hopefully the information presented today, you were able to comprehend and understand completely like the rest of us. And so if any questions, that would be the time. Okay. Therefore, all in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The ayes have it. The motion carries.
The audit committee would like to make a motion that the Finance Commission approve the Department of Savings and Mortgage Lending's fiscal year 2023 operating budget.
Coming upon the recommendation of the audit committee, no second is needed. Members, any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Ayes have it, and the motion carries.
The audit committee would like to make a motion that the finance commission approve the Texas Department of Banking's fiscal year 2023 operating budget.
Coming upon the recommendation of the audit committee, no second is needed. Members, any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Ayes have it, and the motion carries.
The audit committee would like to make a motion that the finance commission approve the activities of the Texas Financial Education Endowment Fund.
Coming upon the recommendation from the audit committee, no second is needed. Members, any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Ayes have it, the motion carries. Thank you, Commissioner Scanlon. Before we move on to the strategic planning report, Commissioner Kripka, would you like to provide any comments for the strategic plan? On the consent agenda. Okay, members, before we take up the consent agenda items A1, A8, B2, B3, C2, D2, and D3 in a single vote, I want to state that any commission members may request that an agenda item be removed from the consent agenda and be placed on the regular agenda so it may be discussed and voted on individually. Members, as a reminder, please state your name before making any seconding a motion. Do I hear a motion to adopt the consent agenda items A1, A8, B2, B3, C2, D2, and D3 without any discussion?
Vince Puente, so moved.
Thank you, sir. Any discussion, members? Hearing none, all in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Ayes have it, and the motion carries.
Yeah, well,
second, I'm sorry.
I will look a second.
Thank you. All right, now on the strategic plan for the commissions.
Members, just a general background before I turn it over to Will Lucas. At the strategic plan, which you have electronic versions and also a hard copy in front of you, just a background. The agencies worked on this, and then we provided our recommendations with obviously a draft to Chair Lucas. That was sent out to the members. Any recommendations or additions or questions were talked by the members. They worked on them together. Then it was sent out to the full finance commission on, I believe it was on July the 29th for your input, provided feedback to the chairman. And then here we are today to vote on the strategic plan. And again, as you can tell, most of the items, which say were more of wordsmithing, are maybe format. Chair Lucas, would you like to make any comments?
Sure, thank you. Commissioner Cooper said, it was provided to the strategic planning committee back early in July, and emailed that out to Vince Puente and Bob Borichoff, and the three of us reviewed the plan after concurring that it was an excellent plan. It was sent out to the entire committee. I trust all of you received it, and I got several positive emails back in support of the plan, but with no suggested changes. Very good plan. I want to thank you to all the departments for your hard work on it, and it's a very sound plan.
And if I could, for the department kind of pulled it together, Jared Whitson and Barbara Winters were really the ones that kind of pulled everything together to provide information to your committee, Chairman Lucas. So thank y'all for your help.
All right, Chairman Holt, with that, if there's no other discussion, the Strategic Planning Committee would like to make a motion that the Finance Commission approve the Finance Commission of Texas 2023-2027 strategic plan.
Coming upon the recommendation of the Strategic Planning Committee, no second is needed. Members, any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Ayes have it, the motion carries. Thank you, Will, for sharing that. Your leadership has been very, very valuable to us, so thank you so much for that. We're now going to move on to item number 7, Commissioner Pettyjohn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Our agency, our priorities for fiscal year 2023 begin on page 17. And these are the outline of the high-level priorities that we have set for fiscal year 2023 within our organization. These align with the budget that the commission just approved. And so these would be the highlighted items. We will report to you on mid-year report on these. We provide you in April typically about how we have progressed on these priorities. And then in October, you'll get the accomplishment report for fiscal year 2022. And then obviously October next year, we will do the accomplishment report for this year. Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure whether you prefer us to go into any level of detail of these. So the structure is fairly similar for all three agencies. The structure is similar to prior years. There's a couple of new items in here, but obviously the focus on our regulatory activities is paramount, but as well as, you know, we have policy and rule development. There's issues that we have related to financial education, stakeholder outreach, and then our agency management issues, as well as a number of our IT projects are mentioned specifically in here for the next fiscal year. And Mr. Chairman, I'd ask how much detail you want, or if that's a high level enough that I'd be happy to answer any questions.
No, I trust our fellow commissioners to read their information before joining us today. And so I know that if they've had any questions, they can present them at this time.
And then one more thing on page 22 is sort of the really detailed performance measure targets and forecasts for the next fiscal year.
And I recognize each agency is already looking ahead to the next legislative session. So we appreciate that too, what you expect to see. Yeah. So if that, does that conclude?
Yes, sir. Yes,
Commissioner Retta.
Thank you. Page 23 begins the agency priorities for fiscal year 2023, and it's based really on the budget and on the strategic plan. I would point out just one from a personal perspective. The first one in terms of monitoring legislation through the 88th legislative session. This will be my first experience in doing that, so I'm looking forward to that. I'm looking forward to learning a great deal from that. Fortunately, I have a very strong team with which to rely, who will provide some guidance and basic infrastructure for me to work with. Most of the others are here are really reiterations. Again, it relates back to the budget, back to the strategic plan. There is a bit of an emphasis that you might know when you read through this on the policy and procedure and the formalization of that. Some programs that we think will improve the policy and procedure, the execution of operations within the department. And with that, concludes my remarks, but answer any questions.
Thank you, sir. Any questions, members? Commissioner.
I'd like to reiterate what Mr. Pettijohn said, a couple of things. We will be following up, as said previously on this, so it's, I call it somewhat of a report card, but it is in line with the budgets that y'all approved. For instance, and here it talks about, for us, talks about being competitive with the FDIC. And things of that nature. It also has components on training, which we are going to focus on. I will point you to item 33, on page 33, item 4-8, work with TxDOT and the Office of the Governor on relocation of the Finance Commission agencies. So that is something we will be focusing on and hopefully have to get some movement. And that's all I have.
There, any questions for the Department of Banking members? If not, do I hear a motion to approve the agency's priorities for fiscal year 2023 for the Commissioner of the Office of Consumer Credit?
Laura Warren, so moved.
Thank you, ma'am. Is there a second?
Second.
Thank you, Ms. McCormick. Any discussion, members? All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none. Ayes have it, motion carries. Next, do I hear a motion to approve the agency's priorities for fiscal year 2023 for the Commissioner of the Department of Savings and Mortgage Lending?
Laura Warren, so moved.
Thank you, ma'am. Is there a second?
Pretty Green, so moved.
Thank you, Mr. Green. Welcome to the club now. Any discussion, members? All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Ayes have it, motion carries. Finally, do I hear a motion to approve the agency's priorities for fiscal year 2023 for the Commissioner of the Texas Department of Banking?
Cliff McCauley, so moved.
Thank you, sir. Second?
Hector Sedna, second.
Thank you, sir. Any discussion? All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Ayes have it, and the motion carries. We will now move on to items 9 through 12. Anything that needed to be discussed in the open session, commissioners? Thank you. So with that, we'll be starting with you, Commissioner Pettyjohn, for your report.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Before I begin with the material in the book, I'll just open with a few broad consumer credit economic indicators of late. We have some second quarter data for 2022 that's in, and we're seeing total household debt rising about 2% in the second quarter, so to reach now $16.15 billion. Credit card balances saw their largest year-over-year increase in more than 20 years. Delinquency has ticked up a little bit, but still remains low compared to historical levels.
Is it 20 years?
20 years. Yep. Consumer confidence index has decreased in July following a larger decline in June. As the Fed has raised interest rates to rein in inflation, the purchasing intentions for cars, homes, and major appliances have all pulled back further in July. If we have continual inflation and additional rate hikes, those are likely to continue posing strong headwinds for consumer spending and economic growth over the next 6 months. Number of total auto loan accounts decreased for the ninth straight quarter. Meanwhile, the average auto loan amount increased again in Q2 as it has continued to increase every quarter since 2010. So we continue to see rising prices or auto loan accounts. Actually, this account balance, it's an account balance, so not necessarily just a new loan, it's what the balance is at the time. Then lastly, light vehicle sales in the U.S. increased 2.3% on a seasonally adjusted basis in June of 2022 from the previous month's sales. However, June's 2022 sales are down about 16% compared to the same month last year. Demand is still somewhat outpacing supply, and lack of inventory still caused by supply chain disruptions continues to be that biggest factor limiting sales, although I think there's some note that some of that is beginning to work its way through. So those are just a few highlights, indicators from a few broad indicators updates. With that, I want to move into the material beginning on page 41. It's information on our examination. Performance, and we are exceeding our production targets. This information is as of the end of June, and I will note that has continued to do our current situation, but at this point we were at about 87% of the fiscal year target had been completed. Additionally, we have completed the new examination type, the requirement to conduct 10 crafted precious metal dealer examinations, which was the new enactment by the legislature. That became effective in January. We have completed those 10 examinations, and so we'll have to figure out how to add those to our chart, but certainly those have been completed. I wanted to mention that we've had, in the middle of July, we had a new financial examiner class begin with two new financial examiners, and so those two individuals who are going to be based in the Dallas area have completed their final classroom training and their testing the week of August the 8th, so recently completed that, and so they are now out in the field with seasoned examiners continuing their training process, but we're grateful to have those, and we're looking forward to hiring our next class. And to prepare us for hiring that next class, we are scheduled to participate in 4 college recruiting fairs in mid-September, and so we're hopeful to generate a little interest through that process. We also have scheduled our annual examiner training conference in person the week of September the 18th, and that'll be scheduled in Kerrville. A little more on examination production, just you'll see the chart at the end of at the bottom of page 41, and you see the comparison year over year between fiscal year 21 and fiscal year 22, and we're up about 12% year over year overall. Various categories, some higher, some lower, but overall 12% up year over year. Moving on to page 42 is the report on the level of compliance amongst the industries. There's all good news there. Everybody's above the 85% benchmark, both at the current point in time as well as the trailing 12 months. So that's all very positive and great work to the industries for their work in ensuring good compliance. And on page 43 is information on investigations, and we have been able to resume from a pandemic pause. You'll see a pretty marked difference between the 21 and 22 completion of investigations. This is a more normal pattern of investigation completion, and we anticipate reaching the targeted number of investigations before the fiscal year end. The bottom of page 43 is information about complaints. It's normal activity. We're seeing a little uptick in complaints closed in Q3, but otherwise fairly normal activity on complaints. On page 45, I was just going to mention the top category and highlight our top complaint types for motor vehicle sales finance. And these typically continue to be the top complaints that we see. Repossession is always a key issue in motor vehicle sales finance complaints. Contract issues, these are often around what we might say is the origination or at the time of contract, but people might have issues with their contract. And then we have this category called questionable business practice, which we have mentioned as some of the challenges with in the current environment. We've got complaints about dealers not accepting outside financing and some of those kind of issues, but those are the top issues. And you see somewhat similar patterns in some of the other areas, but of course this is our top category of complaint. And if you look on page 46, even the ratio of complaints closed to active licensees and registrants, that the motor vehicle sales finance is in the top category of that as well. So, very active area for us, and we continue to work on those complaint issues. Moving on to licensing on page 47, we completed the pawn shop renewal cycle, and we had 98% of pawn shops renew, which was good considering we're expecting about 95%. So we have a little stronger retention there. And we also expected about 50% of the optional pawn shop employees would renew, or the optional requirement for licensure that those would renew. And we ended up seeing 63% of those renew. So a little stronger pattern of retention across the pawn shops. I've noted with some interest a recent article talking about increased activity in pawn shops, just with the economic conditions and some of the stresses that they're beginning to see. And typically they're a counter-cyclical business. When you start to have some weakness in some economic trends, they begin to see an increase in activity. So we're beginning to see a few reports about that. In the middle of the page, we talk about incoming license applications. And so we've begun to see a bit of a drop-off over this year. We're seeing about 125 applications, new business license applications coming in monthly. And that's about 12% below our prior fiscal year average, which had been running pretty strong for a number of years. So we're seeing a slight decline, a little more than slight maybe, but some decline in those incoming applications. So we'll be watching that number pretty closely to see if that trend persists or whether or not we see a little bit of change. Our licensing dashboard of the regulated entities is on page 48. Really not much to report here. Super stable. If you look at, especially at the bottom right chart there, very, very stable activity represented here in the populations. In fact, you know, it's almost so stable for the last six quarters overall. So pretty stable activity. Even though there's still the churn of in and outs happening, overall the level's holding very, very constant. On page 49 is information on our financial education in the Texas Financial Education Endowment. We're grateful to welcome a new grant education and communication specialist. Patricia is here with us. We wave, and we welcome her to our financial education program and to our financial education endowment. We're looking forward to new opportunities in that area. Communication activities. It's been the summer schedule of appearances for different industry conferences, and those are listed for you in the middle of the page. And We're always grateful to have those opportunities and the invitations that the industry trade organizations provide for us to come and speak to their groups. And it's usually a really good opportunity to learn from them, as well as to provide some information we hope is helpful to all work together towards improving compliance. Current posted staff vacancies are listed there. We continue to be actively working, trying to recruit and hire and fill some of these positions. Again, some challenges out there in that particular area, but we continue to diligently apply ourselves towards that activity.
Commissioner?
Sir.
Okay, before we get beyond this
Sir.
Section, there's two questions. Bottom page 42 is our chart on acceptable compliance levels.
Yes, sir.
And I think I ask this every other time, so I apologize. But I never understand how the cap goes down to 0%. And may I just don't understand the chart that well, but could you once again educate me on
that? Certainly. Well, it has to do, but this chart is a little bit confusing, but it provides a trailing 12 months. And we went through a period of time when there weren't a lot of CAB, because a lot of these CABs are now being done as large enterprise exams. And it depends on when they were performed. But we went through a period of time where we either had no exams or we had very few exams. And of the exams that we had done in the prior 12 months, all of the entities that we had examined did not have satisfactory compliance. And then, you know, we roll 12 months, you know, in the trailing 12 months, the next quarter, somebody that had a positive experience, then, you know, that now has a large number of licensees that have satisfactory compliance, moves that number up. And so it's just that window of a quarter. We captured 12 months where we didn't have anybody that was in satisfactory compliance. A lot of that's because we just hadn't done any exams in that area, because so many of them, we do these large bulk group of exams, and we might have gone a long period of time between those bulk exams.
So specifically in the second quarter of this year, you're saying y'all probably just didn't do any exams?
We didn't have many exams in that category for credit access businesses. We do these enterprise-wide, and so we might do 200 licenses on an enterprise-wide level examination. And so during this window, there were, and this is a 12-month period, but there were not very many examinations that had been conducted in this from Q1 21 to Q2 22. There was a small number of examinations, and of those, all of them had been non-compliant. Again, it's a little bit confusing because it's the trailing 12 months. But the reason we put it in here is because early in the year, these tend to do just the fiscal year activity for examination. So early in the year, you may only get a month or two of compliance, and that doesn't really give you any kind of historical perspective about what's happened. So
is this unique to CAPS? It seems like it's...
It was unique to them at that point in time, and it may continue to be. We're trying to be sure that we do a little better job of scheduling on a more regular basis, so we don't have some of those gaps in there like we had this last time when they examined these enterprise exams were done, so that there was a large gap of time in between. So we're trying to make sure that those get done earlier in the fiscal year, so we don't have that kind of aberration in the data.
Issue.
Somewhat, yes, I would say so.
Then on page 50, the turnover, 17.5%.
Yes.
That seems high, but maybe I'm just not remembering how we typically are.
It's nearly a
fifth of your entire population.
It's on the high side. We've always said in our organization that, you know, 15%, we try to stay under 15%. We have had 18% before. It's not unheard of. I mean, you know, state government turnover overall is higher than that. And it's my understanding from some information I read recently. I can't remember the exact number, but it's not where we want to be. We do know we sometimes tend to have a lot higher turnover in some of our examiner positions because they travel so frequently, and some folks desire not to travel. So it is an uptick. I mean, we still expect we're going to have some issues. Some of we've been impacted this year. It's been kind of unique in some of our OSTA positions is we've had several, I'm almost calling them false starts. We've had some employees that we've hired that have not lasted with us very long. And so they're in and out pretty quickly. We haven't invested a whole lot in them, but we had at least three of those in our organization that happened. And that impacts, when you have a small number of staff, you know, the percentage swings are kind of high. So that's the other impact of that. So we certainly are working to try to stem that, but we agree that it's higher than we'd like it to be.
Thank you.
You bet. And then on page 51, here are some of our, there's three, our technology report on technology modernization and deployment. There's just information related to three recent projects, IT projects this summer that we have successfully deployed. And so we're pleased that we've been able to get these deployed and to, they've either modernized our platforms or helped improve our cybersecurity posture. So we're very grateful that those have deployed successfully. And there's a lot of work that goes into a lot of these IT projects, and they can be somewhat disruptive even to the entire staff. But I think long-term, it leaves the agency in an improved position. On page, the county reports on 52, I really don't have anything to mention there, but on page 53, there's one measure we report that really only shows up in this particular report on a quarterly basis, and it's the very first line, and it's some of the work that we do when we're performing an examination or a complaint, resolving a complaint for that matter. But if we find violations, we find situations that require monies to be returned to consumers or restitution to be provided, we order that. We verify that, and we keep track of that metric, and we report it from time to time. It's one of those things that some folks might look as an effectiveness measure, perhaps, or an outcome measure associated with our organization. But the number for this year has been fairly significant compared to the prior years, and we're looking at about $24 million as of the end of May that has been returned to consumers as a result of those activities. You will see it in a year-end report, but it only gets reported quarterly on this executive summary, so I just want to highlight that. On page 54 are the rest of our performance, our output measures. You'll show that three of the four output measures have been met or exceeded. Only one is not being met or exceeded, and that relates to business license application processing. We're not only are we receiving fewer, we've been a little slower in processing some of those business license applications because of some of the staffing issues as well as dealing with some of the renewal cycles. So we hope that that's going to improve a bit in Q4, but that's been a little bit of a challenge. So that concludes the operations report. And let me call upon Michael to come provide the legal report from page 55.
Morning, members. Michael Rigby, General Counsel for the Office of Consumer Credit Commissioner. The legal report begins on page 55 of your materials. I want to provide you with a few updates. The first one is on the Clay Cooley entities litigation. The first one listed there. Last time we met, we had just concluded the hearing at the State Office of Administrative Hearings back in June. Since that time in July, both sides provided closing briefs. And then just this week, both sides provided responses to those closing briefs. At this point, we expect the administrative law judge to issue a proposal for decision sometime in mid-October, and hopefully before the next Finance Commission meeting, I'll have an update for you on that case. Any questions about Clay Cooley? The next thing I wanted to mention is on page...
Let me go back and ask Clay. Is this a great deal of money that they would have to refund?
$1.9 million.
Okay, now I understand. No, go ahead.
Okay. And that's about a year's worth of overcharges and documentary fees.
Oh my gosh.
They collected documentary fees of $150, which they can keep because that's the amount set by the Finance Commission as reasonable. But the $1.9 million is extra money beyond $150 documentary fee.
Good about selling cars, just collect the fee.
Yes, sir. The next thing I wanted to discuss is on page 58 of the materials. At the very top, there's some rule actions. The rule actions in this packet have been adopted by consent agenda. There's some additional notes on there about what's coming up in October. Wanted to add to that, we're also working with Department of Banking and Savings and Mortgage Lending on some administrative rules that are due for review in October. So you'll be hearing from all the agencies on that rule review next meeting. And then just below that, there's an update on the Pope litigation. This is an employment lawsuit filed in Houston. When we last met, the trial was set for September of this year, and it was moved by the judge to October, the two-week trial docket for the meeting in October. And that's all the information I have about the Pope. That concludes my legal report.
Members, any questions for Mr. Rigby this morning? Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, that concludes our agency report since our rules were on consent.
So thank you so much. We'll be moving on to Department of Savings and Mortgage Lending. Commissioner Reddick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I can draw your attention to page 75 where the Department of Savings and Mortgage Lending report begins. We'll start with the Thrift Regulation Division activities. Before I say that, just a couple of preliminary comments or table-setting comments. Certainly, with respect to mortgage, the increase in the mortgage rates in response to the inflation that I think we're all quite familiar with has had an impact on builder confidence, on housing starts. So that does have an impact on activity. I think we made reference to this last time, we're beginning to see that activity in things like licensing applications. And so that trend will continue. And as far as the banks overall, I think we're looking at banks, as you noted here, that no supervisory actions are in place. But the banks generally are stable and well-positioned. Whatever slowdown may occur in activity, they're well-positioned to be able to do that. But I would underline saying that this is really when the supervisory responsibility is important to stay on top of what's going on within the industry and with individual banks. Getting into the particulars on the Thrift Regulation Division activities, you can see that now we have 21 state savings banks with just over $465 billion in total assets. As noted earlier, they are sound. There are no supervisory actions in place, as shown in the table below, with banks rated 1 or 2. In terms of the examination, on-site examinations have been going on now for some time. The FDIC recently announced that they will be coming out and joining beginning limited on-site in September. So we will see more of them present in some of the examinations that take place. There was no merger activity approved or effective since the last Finance Commission meeting. And then I will note one other thing. We do have Thrift Industry Day, which is an annual day briefing for all of the savings banks that will be held on the 22nd of September in the afternoon, beginning at 12:30. And certainly the Finance Commission, all Finance Commission members are invited to attend that. It will be at the AT&T Executive Education and Conference Center here in Austin.
Mr. Commissioner, I'm sorry, and I've noticed a couple of meetings. I think it's just something about where you're sitting and maybe where I'm sitting, but I struggle to hear you. Maybe I need to go get my ears checked, but maybe you could give me a little bit more volume.
All right. Okay, I'll raise the volume. How's that? I'll try to project a little bit more. Sorry. That's because I'm soft-spoken, I suppose. My wife would argue with that sometimes. Let's move down on page 76 to the Mortgage Regulation Division activities. As I noted earlier, we're going through in the mortgage side through an adjustment period with rates being what they are. I mentioned that the originations market is down, but that's all to be expected. However, if you looked at the table on that page, again on page 76, the number of licensee registrations and branch locations as of July 31st in comparison to last year, it's a significant increase over last year, but reflected the active volume that we've had really in that industry through the latter part of last year and the beginning of this year. If we move to page 77 in terms of the licensee activity report, you can see by the number of applications processed, 7,317 applications and approved 6,316 applications.
But I'll back on the mortgage company. That 42% increase from 21 over 22. Do we see those renewing, or do we see that returning back to normal, or that
I think
we'll maintain that high number?
We anticipate that will normalize. Again, I think that reflects a lot of the activity that was the latter part of last year.
That's huge.
If you look at the licensing activity report again on page 77, there what is noticeable is that month to month we're seeing the number of applications declining, close to in July, 50% of what it was a year ago in terms of mortgage applications coming in. And so that's not too surprising given, again, what's going on in the mortgage market. In terms of the mortgage examination activity down, staying on top of that in terms of the number of individual licenses that have been examined and on a year-to-date basis, and you'll see that again on the next page, or the next couple of pages, really right on target to be able to do that. To achieve the performance measures that we had out there, the output measures that we had listed on. And then in terms of the examinations themselves and what we found, the number of violations related to unlicensed independent loan processors and unlicensed RMLOs and record keeping, and some of those things don't change, so those are the same kind of things that seem to come up. In terms of outreach and training, I'm at the bottom of page 77. We did have occasion, Director of Mortgage Regulation William Purse and I, to speak with the North Texas Association of Mortgage Professionals and the Greater Houston Association of Mortgage Professionals. And I'll say that these are excellent opportunities to really the meetings after the meeting are very important in terms of the input we get from industry. We sit and have a number of conversations, a number of questions that they raise. So that's, I think, particularly important when you have a changing landscape in terms of the mortgage market for us to be out in the market and hear what's going on. So that has helped me personally, I think, to help us as a department as well. On page 78, we move into the operations division's report. I think the numbers are broken out in terms of we are 59 regular full-time employees. As you know from discussions earlier with respect to the budget, we're looking at 70 next year, 70 full-time employees. But it's the challenges of being able to hire people and attract people to come to work. We too have launched the intern program, so we'll be getting started with that this fall and hope to have some long-term, short-term and long-term results, positives that come out of that. I will note one other thing on the human resource side. We had a considerable effort that was put into going through and updating all the job descriptions, all the competencies for the different jobs, and on the performance evaluations in depth this time around. And that was really in response to what we had received as some input from the last survey of employee engagement. We wanted to really up our game in terms of making certain that all of the staff is aware of the interest that we have in their career development and the interest that we have in how they're performing and being upfront. So I would say that Antonia Antoff and her team did a really outstanding job of making certain that we did that throughout the world. While I'm talking about operations, I'll say too, I cannot enough express the really superlative job that was done on the budget preparation by Antonio himself and her team. It's a big responsibility, and when you're doing it at the same time that you're doing the comprehensive effort on job descriptions and performance evaluations, she and her team were very busy in the last couple of months, so I want to make sure that I mention that. If we look down to, if I can take you to the next page on page 79, or the output measures, as I indicated there, I think we're on top of it in every respect in terms of the thrift, safety, and soundness, mortgage regulation, consumer responsiveness. And so I think we're tracking well with respect to the outputs. And if there's not a question up until now, then I would ask for Ernest Garcia to step up and provide the legal division activity report.
Good morning, Chairman Holt, Commissioners. Ernest Garcia, General Counsel for the Department of Savings and Mortgage Lending. The department's legal activity report begins on page 8 of your materials. With respect to the complaints received and the types of violations, for the third quarter of fiscal year 22, we had 436 complaints. That's a 6% decrease when compared to the same period in fiscal year 21. And within that 436 volume of complaints, there was a bit of an uptick in loan modification issues and reverse mortgage servicing types of complaints. Bottom half of page 80, we've reported in the past with respect to the types of respondents in relation to our complaints. The volume continues to be the majority in relation to mortgage bankers, again, because of the servicing activity. Moving to page 81, as far as the aging of open complaints, as of June 30th of 22, there were 92 open files, with 99% of those aged 90 days or less, and the one file that was aged more than 90 days has since been closed. Regarding the types of the violations or open complaints, rather, that existed as of the end of June, again, the majority of those were in relation to loan servicing that we were still working on.
In loan servicing, the paperwork that didn't seem right. Is that what you mean by that?
It's a variety of issues. I mean, when individuals are making their payments, you know, part of their they're making their payment to the servicers, and oftentimes there's disputes about the escrow amounts, taxes, and insurance, whether certain amounts were paid and credited, and you know, some people try to make an extra payment, and then they question the accounting of that, and a lot of times it has to do with communication. We find that the consumers reach out to the servicers, and maybe the servicers are just overwhelmed with the volume of work they have, and then the consumers get angry, and then ultimately file a complaint, and then we work to try to get the parties to collaborate and work things out.
The servicers, are they in between the actual mortgage company, or are they employed by the mortgage company?
Well, so more often than not, it can vary. It can vary. But more often than not, the servicing is done by an entity other than the originator of the loan. And that, you know, is an industry in itself, which is why it's regulated under a different chapter. So they register with us. And so the servicers, they receive a fee, and they remit part of the money they have, obviously the PI, principal and interest, to the lender or the owner of the note. And then, of course, they're responsible for taxes and insurance. And if for whatever reason there's a shortage and the individuals don't pay that, then there's forced place insurance and they deal with that as well.
Thank you.
Sure. Moving to page 82, with respect to the third quarter closed complaints, those that are being closed within 90 days, we averaged 98.2%. For both categories, both those complaints dealing with servicing issues and then those complaints that were not servicing related. Middle page 82, for the third quarter, we had 9 enforcement actions. With respect to recovery and mortgage grant fund applications, those are summarized at the bottom of page 82. The 3 that were approved that relate to matters that we had both prior to March 1st of 22 and subsequent to March 1st of 22, the 3 resulted in our department will be issuing out about $29,000 to various consumers. We, as of this report, we showed 2 matters that we're still investigating that we had received prior to March 1st and then 2 subsequent. And then in the meantime, subsequent to the issuance of this report, we received a couple more. So right now we're investigating about this. Moving to page 83, here we kind of summarize the administrative cases, the State Office of Administrative Matters. The one at the top is Rackley. Now that was a denial of a recovery fund application. That was a hearing was held on August the 15th, but the administrative law judge decided to continue it to September 15th. In large part because the Rackleys apparently had difficulty uploading their exhibits. And So the ALJ decided to go ahead and continue the case again. With respect to the Lou matter, which is about the middle of the page, that was a license application denial case. As reported last time, the hearing was held on July 15, and then the ALJ gave Ms. Lou, a California RMLO, an opportunity to submit more evidence subsequent to the hearing, and so that matter is still under advisement, and we're waiting for the ALJ's PFD or proposal for decision on that. The Thomas matter, that hearing on the merits was held on August 4th. And that was also a license denial case, and we're awaiting a proposal for decision on that one. The very last matter on page 83 involves Eldridge Cloud. That was another recovery fund application that we denied. And Mr. Cloud has appealed that, and that is scheduled for a contested hearing next week on August 4th.
Can I ask you a question back about the Ruckley? Again, it's just to help me understand.
Yes, sir.
So the Ruckleys are trying to get $60,000 from CalSLO. Is that correct?
Right.
And why do they believe they are owed $60,000?
Well, they were moving forward and trying to get a loan, and ultimately the loan didn't go forward. And so they're, the way we view it, they're not out of pocket the money because they're just angry because they didn't get the loan. That's our opinion.
Did they check for $60,000, or they're just saying they're damaged by $60,000?
They're saying they're damaged, but they didn't. So the recovery fund statute provides that if you dealt with somebody that's licensed and they violated the finance code, in a list of particulars, for example, acting in a fraudulent or deceptive manner, then it allows for the department, after they investigate, to maybe agree with that. But it has to be in relation to out-of-pocket expenses, right? So you've got two pieces there. One is there sufficient evidence to prove that one of these statutory provisions was violated? So it can't just be that because the deal didn't go through, right? That's not going to be enough to get you recovery. And then second of all, it can't just be, well, you know, had that deal gone through, I would have been, you know, a millionaire. It can't just be all kinds of damages. It's got to be true out-of-pocket costs that the recovery fund is limited to. And so in this case, there really, you know, weren't any out-of-pocket costs. And in fact, with respect to the inspection and the appraisal, the lender said, hey, we'll cover it.
Okay.
And but so they're still angry.
Oh, well. And there's no evidentiary support.
We don't believe so, with all due respect. But they're adamant. They want their day in court, and they're entitled to it. All citizens are entitled to their day in court, and they're entitled to it. And in this case, everything went forward. Everybody was present. The ALJ was asking the Rackleys about their evidence, and they say, well, we've got lots of evidence. Well, did you upload it? Not real sure. And so they didn't.
Item E down at the bottom is the same circumstance.
Cloud?
Yes.
So Cloud's a little bit different. Each one of these cases is a little bit different. So Cloud was an individual, if you don't mind, sir, I'll give you an answer to that. Cloud is an individual that applied for, went to an RMLO. And he said, I'd like you assistance because I want to see about buying a house. And I'd like down payment assistance. And I'd like you to help me do that through the city of Austin. And the RMLO said, okay, fine. And so the RMLO assisted him with the application of down payment assistance and got it for him. And then he said, you know, here's what the city of Houston will do for you. The individual then went out with a realtor, put a contract on a piece of property, and then came back and said, you know, everything's fantastic. And except that the property that he put a contract on was not in the city of Houston.
Oh.
And surprisingly, the City of Houston Down Payment Assistance Program is for City of Houston residents. So then he said, well, this is unfortunate. So I guess I need down payment assistance from Harris County. And the RMLO said, well, okay. So this RMLO worked with this individual for like over a year. Got the down payment assistance from Harris County. Here's the problem. That original seller that did the deal on that property that was not in the City of Houston, but was in the county, said, I am tired of waiting. And I have this other buyer that's willing to do the deal and can close, and I'm tired, so I'm not going to extend it any further. So he's now wanting us to pay his out-of-pocket expenses, for example, in relation to like an inspection, appraisal, so claiming that it's the RMLO's fault. And we don't believe there he had out-of-pocket expenses, right? So it's not that element that we think he can't meet. I don't believe, though, on behalf of the department, that he can meet one of these other statutory elements.
Yeah.
You know, and let me also say, I mean, there is a consequence. If we pay out on the recovery fund, you know, the RMLO has the opportunity, for example, to try to enter into an arrangement to make that deal. But if they don't, that fact that we did pay out is going to cause the problems in any place.
Yeah.
So,
of course, I can't figure if you can't afford the down payment, I can't afford the house, but that's a whole different issue.
Well, sir, that's a whole nother issue that's beyond the scope of my ability to speak on that.
Thank you very much.
There are government services and that provide to consumers.
I have a question. If you give him money, that opens up a can of worms for so many people that if they lose the house, they're going to come and want their appraisals. And there's so many reasons to lose a house over instead of down payment assistance.
Well, so I don't disagree with your comment at all. So we essentially act as stewards of the funds, the recovery fund. And when individuals make these claims, it takes us some time to investigate. I'm sure you all know that you look at a loan closing file, it's not 5 pages long. It's hundreds and hundreds of pages, sometimes over 1,000 pages. So you're looking at LEs, you're looking at CDs, you're looking at the various fair housing, you're looking at the equal credit, you're looking at all those types of disclosures, and then of course you're looking at the overall transaction, and then you're looking at what relationship did the originator have with like a loan assistant, and how involved was the loan assistant. So you have to look at all of that, because sometimes the consumer's is out of pocket some money, but doesn't really know how to articulate what the statutory violation is. So they'll still submit a claim, right? And so then we get the claim. And we're not going to just deny it because they didn't cite the exact statute. We have to kind of look at the whole package and say, well, you know, did it violate one of our laws? Did it violate a federal law or regulation or something like that? Or do we feel like there's not enough evidence? Or ultimately, was it not a quote out of pocket? So do a preliminary determination letter to approve and then some to deny. And then, of course, if they disagree with our decision, they have the ability to appeal it to the State Office of Administrative Appearance.
Do we know if the consumers in either of these two actions are proceeding independently against other parties outside of the administrative process?
To my knowledge, no. If I had to speculate further on that, I would say that it's not costly to appeal to SOA and to get on your computer and have a hearing. Whereas if you were to file a district court cause of action, the court filing fees, an attorney fee perhaps, and depending on the court, they may or may not have the virtual options. So it can get, obviously, you all know litigation can get pretty expensive. But to my knowledge, there is no litigation, and I'm sure that the RMLOs would have said, well, you know, we're already involved in litigation here, and that hasn't been the case. And then, of course, the consumers know that the reason there's an administrative process is because that's an effort to kind of make it more friendly to consumers, to give them an opportunity to resolve things without having to go the full-blown litigation route, and yet still preserve their ability to appeal to a district court. So they still have that option as well. So the whole scheme of administrative law is meant to make it easier for parties to resolve things and to decrease the congestion in courts of law. Moving to page 84, the one actual litigation matter that the department is still involved in involves Wagner, and that is before the Third Court of Appeals. It's been fully briefed, and the department is just waiting for the court to render a decision. With respect to public information requests, we had an uptick in the third quarter of this year at 44. Only one of those was sent to the AG's office for a determination of not releasing the documents, and they agreed with us that those documents should not be released in that situation. On page 85, we talk about future rules, not only those coming up in October, but also fiscal year 23, the rule review of the Savings Loan Association rule chapters. Bottom of page 85, gift reporting, Justin Cola went to the 2022 National Test Maintenance Committee meeting in June 8th and 9th, and the State Regulatory Registry, which is part of the CSBS, paid the expenses for that, totaling $471.56. So that was essentially a gift to the department. As far as legislative activities, you know, the department continues to monitor things at the federal level, but we're also looking forward to the upcoming 88th legislative session. So we're mindful that the legislature actually starts in January and will go through the end of May, but the members of the legislature can start pre-filing here mid-November. And while the department, as previously stated, doesn't lobby, the department oftentimes gets asked by members of the legislature to comment on pieces of statutory provisions that may or may not impede commerce or that may not be consistent with federal law and so forth. And the only two things that we've identified that are technical changes. So as a result of the last session, the 87th session, y'all may recall that we talked about how the legislature created the mortgage grant fund, and when they did that, they made some changes in relation to how the recovery fund operates. So there's a few changes that we think would be best if they were kind of streamlined out within that provision. And then the same thing with respect to the wrap mortgage financing. Because although that created Chapter 159, there were provisions of that that kind of impacted a few of the other chapters, and there's a word or two here that maybe are not consistent with the other changes. So we kind of consider those technical, small changes, and those are some that if given the opportunity, we would bring up. In addition, you know, there's various hearings that come up from time to time, and we try to monitor those. For example, next Thursday, PIFS, Pensions, Investments, and Financial Services, the House Committee, will be reviewing House Bill 1258, which has to do with data matching between financial institutions and the Comptroller's Office for purposes of collecting delinquent taxes due to the state. So that's a hearing coming up this Thursday. It's something that relates to the prior legislative session, but we're going to be monitoring that as well. Happy to answer any questions that y'all might have for me. If not, I will be followed by Deputy General Counsel Ken Berry.
Good job.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Morning.
Morning, Mr. Berry.
Mr. Chair, Ian Berry, Department of Savings and Mortgage Lending.
This agenda item begins on page 86 of your materials. Agenda items 3, 4, and 5 are related, and I will largely address all these agenda items in this presentation. This comes to you on rule review of the savings bank rules. These are located in Chapter 75, 76, and 77 of 7 TAC Part 4. Rule review is a process in Government Code 2001.039 where rules are reviewed every 4 years, which presents a good opportunity to take a fresh look at the rules and make any improvements. And these changes were identified during that process. As a reminder, you all adopted Agenda Item 2 on the consent agenda, which was the adoption of the rule review, which basically readopted Chapters 75, 76, 77. So on to the changes. As I mentioned, the existing rules are in 75, 76, and 77. The primary purpose is to reorganize the rules and consolidate them into Chapter 75. And this is similar to what we did last go around where we swapped Chapters 51 and 52. So where it's an ongoing effort to sort of restructure our rules, make them more straightforward and easier to find and easier to read. So we would consolidate these into Chapter 75. And then the subject matter of 76 and 77 would obviously then be transferred over. And then in the two agenda items that follow, the rules in those existing chapters would be repealed. So in a sense, as you look at this agenda item, you're looking at the rules in all of those chapters. Obviously, we regulate two industries and several different types of regulated persons. And so when viewing our rules as a whole, it's somewhat difficult to discern which of the rules applies to the savings banks. So this is an effort to sort of label it savings banks on the front end. As you walk through that first door of our rules, you'll see which door that you want to walk through next. It also allows for rules of general applicability. So things like definitions that can apply chapter-wide versus having three chapters where you have definitions in each chapter. So I would suggest to you that it may seem like a monumental change just because I think the pages in agenda item 2 are about 70 pages. So it seems like a lot, and it is monumental in terms of changing the architecture, but I would suggest to you it's incremental in terms of its substance. However, and here comes the however, in doing this process, we did identify that the rules, certain rules in Chapter 77, specifically Section 77.2 through 77.9, could be repealed. These deal with loan requirements that are imposed on the savings banks. In looking at those with sort of fresh eyes, we found that perhaps they were not necessary. Federal law already dictates largely what loans can take place, and also market forces also do that. And so with that in mind, we found this represented in perhaps unnecessary layer of regulation and one that we could pull down. At best, the rules didn't do much, and perhaps at worst, they could stymie innovation at a time when loan products are rapidly evolving, including due to changes in technology. And of course, the department's examination program is there to and in place to, if there's any issues of safety and soundness, we're there to catch that. So that is there for that purpose. And of course, while we're doing rule review, we also tried to make other changes to modernize the rules, more simple language, take out unnecessary language, make things more readable. So we tried to do that here. In terms of procedure, we published a pre-comment notice with an initial draft of the rules, and then on July the 19th, held a stakeholders webinar concerning the pre-comment draft. New changes were made as a result of the stakeholders meeting. Preamble in your packet has an explanation of the new rules and repeals and the purpose behind it. So unless you have questions, the department would recommend publishing the rules in the Texas Register for comment.
Members, do we have any questions for Mr. Berry this morning on this matter?
No questions, just comment. Thank you so much for the commentary we received. I didn't realize and stayed in my mind. We had the word child 111 times. So the purpose of this is to make it more useful for the public. You know, when we go in there, we're trying to see if we're compliant or not. It makes it a lot easier. So thank you for the efforts.
Thank you very much for that comment. Yes, the statute uses the word shall enough. I don't think you need to glom on that.
Any other questions, members? If there's anyone wishing to address the commission for our SML rule, item number 3 from the public today, seeing none, do I hear a motion to approve the proposal and publication for comment of new rules and repeals in 710, Part 4, Chapter 75, concerning applications resulting from the rule review?
Laura Warren, so moved.
Thank you, Commissioner. Any discussion? I need a second. I'm sorry.
Vince Fuentes, second.
Thank you. Any discussion, members? Hearing none, all in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Ayes have it. The motion carries. Mr. Berry.
Agenda item 4 begins on page 150 of your packet. As I mentioned, these are 3, 4, and 5 are related, so I will make this short. As I mentioned, this proposal would repeal all existing rules in Chapter 76. That subject matter would then transfer over to Chapter 75 as proposed. Unless you have any questions, we recommend that the Finance Commission approve publication of the rule repeals in the Texas Register.
Thank you. Are members, any questions or comments from Mr. Berry's head? Seeing none, anyone else from the crowd would like to make a comment? No one. So at this time, do I hear a motion to approve the proposal and publication for comment of repeals in 7TAC Part 4, Chapter 76, concerning miscellaneous resulting from rule review?
Debbie Scanlon, so moved.
Thank you, ma'am. Is there a second?
Chair McCormick, second.
Thank you. Members, any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Ayes have it, and the motion carries. Mr. Berry, you're still up.
Mr. Chair, agenda item 6 begins on page 161. Excuse me. Agenda item 5 begins on page 156. I'm getting ahead of myself. I could have recorded what I just said and modified a word or two, but again, this would repeal all the rules on existing Chapter 77, transfer those that subject matter over to Chapter 75. So unless you all have any questions, we recommend that the Finance Commission approve publication of the rule repeals in the Texas Register.
Thank you, sir. Members, any questions? Seeing none, anyone from the audience? Seeing none. Do I hear a motion to approve the proposal and publication for the comment of repeals in 710, Part 4, Chapter 77, concerning loans, investments, savings, and deposits resulting from the rule review?
Will Lucas, so moved.
Thank you, sir. Second?
Debbie Scanlon, second.
Thank you, ma'am. Members, any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Ayes have it, and the motion carries. Mr. Berry.
Mr. Chair, now agenda item 6 begins on page 161 of your materials. We so often mention when something is rule review, so I'll mention the opposite. This is not rule review. A little bit of background. As you heard General Counsel Garcia mention, we regulate mortgage loan servicers. This arises from Chapter 158, in which a residential mortgage loan servicer is a person who receives the payment of the loan and then transfers that payment onto the lender or the person holding the note. And then, as we mentioned, often handles items such as escrow, taxes and insurance, and also loss mitigation if that loan were to go into default. Section 158.055 of Chapter 158 requires that a residential mortgage loan servicer, in order to qualify for the registration, maintain a surety bond so that in the event that the commissioner were to take action against the servicer for a violation and either assess a penalty or find that payment of restitution should be made, that if the servicer were to be unable to pay that, that there would be a backstop, i.e. the surety bond. So the rule, which is being modified by this proposal, is Section 79.4. This rule was originally adopted in January of 2012 and has been untouched since then. The kind of purpose behind this is a lot has happened since 2012. There's been a growing trend in the industry on surety bonds that they'd be electronic. Like most things in life, things are moving in that direction. It used to be you needed a blue paper title for your car, and now it's electronic. So similar here, there's an electronic surety bond. It does offer some advantages. Since they're electronic, obviously the receipt of that is all going to be digital. That can be housed digitally. We use the NMLS system, which obviously means things are uploaded. There's not a vault of documents elsewhere. And so that aids in that process. And then on renewal, rather than reviewing a renewal certificate on the bond, the electronic surety bond is perpetual. So it continues to go into existence in perpetuity until it's either revoked by the surety or it's paid out and they need a new one. And so the existing rule largely was tailored towards the paper bond. So it requires things like a power of attorney be attached. It requires the appearance of the surety seal. And so the intent here is to render the rule compatible with electronic surety bonds with the notion that we would phase it in. So perhaps in the next registration cycle, which would be calendar year 2023, with renewals opening in November of this year, that we allow for electronic surety bonds by making sure this rule doesn't upset the apple cart there, allow them to proceed. And then folks that want to adopt it can, and then with an eye towards calendar year 2024, perhaps making it mandatory, which has been, that's where the consensus is in the industry. Most folks that are part of this process on the other states, most of them already allow electronic surety bonds and most of them actually mandate them. So we're moving in that direction, not all at once, but phasing it in. And perhaps we'll come back once we're looking towards the mandatory portion of this. We'll look at coming back to this rule, revisiting it, learn all the lessons that we've learned by doing this phased in approach, and then bake that into the rule at that time. And so unless you have any questions, the preamble in your packet, it contains an explanation of the rule amendments and the actual text. Unless you have any questions, the department recommends that the Finance Commission approve publication of the amendments in the Texas Register.
Members, any comments or questions for Mr. Berry this morning? If there's anyone wishing to address the commission from the crowd today on item number 6, seeing none, do I hear a motion to approve the proposal and publication for comment of amendments in 7 TAG Part 4 of Chapter 79, Section 79.4 concerning bond requirements?
Will Lucas, so move.
Second.
Laura Warren, second.
Thank you. Also, initials are opposing, so it's pretty easy. Any discussion, members? All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Ayes have it. The motion carries. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Chairman Holt, members.
Mr. Retta, is that?
This concludes the report.
I do have a question.
Yes.
Commissioner Retta. I noticed that there wasn't any report on the turnover of the department like we have in the other reports.
Oh, because we're going to wait for the next meeting when we could provide the fourth quarter numbers on that.
Okay. Where are the other departments able to do it this meeting?
We could, for consistency, we can adapt to make it that way. It's just that the fourth quarter would give the definite numbers on what occurred during the quarter. It would be mid-quarter reported now.
Yeah, I do think for consistency, we're looking at all this information and the reports are pretty consistent, so it makes it easier to review. So it looked like something was missing to me.
Okay. No, if it pleases the Finance Commission, then we can do that.
Thank you.
Sure.
And further from the SML, Department of Banking, Commissioner Cooper, you're on deck.
So our starts on page 169, but before I go into our report, I'd like to mention two retirements that we have. We talked earlier about losses in our personnel, so these are two I want to mention specifically. And so it's obviously a retirement like these are a sense of loss for the department. I would say for me a sense of loss, sadness for me personally, but certainly gratitude for these two individual servants. So speaking, telling you who they are, Larry Walker, regional director of our Dallas regional office, is retired, or actually retired last month. Larry, 42 years of service with the department. And I will have to say that early in his career, he was one of the examiners that examined the bank that I was at in Dallas. So I've known Larry for a long time. So he certainly will be missed. We posted the job. We have two very qualified candidates that are posted, and we will be doing interviews on that. So sadness to lose Larry, certainly an opportunity for our younger people to move up. And then the number two person, Everett Job, who some of you may know. Everett is titled as senior counsel. He previously was general counsel for the department, retired, then came back. So he's leaving again at the end of the month. But in total, Everett has 36 years with the department. And I cannot say enough about Everett's impact on the department. He's known statewide as being banks call him, legislators call him to get his input, institutional knowledge, etc. So again, two losses, but it'll be an opportunity also. So we wish both of those well. So on page 169, on our number of banks, the number is down to 213. For the first time on this chart, our assets under supervision went down slightly, but as of today, that number is back up. So I just think that was just a little dip right there. And you should see the number of trust companies that we have, and our foreign bank branches are the same. On page 170, down at the bottom, we talk about the quote problem banks. So it keeps going down. So we're down to seven. So that is a good number, and we hope it stays that way. On page 171, our enforcement activities, basically, I'll call it flat. Down at the bottom would be our compliance with examination priorities. We are in compliance with everything except the DOB led IT exams and our foreign branches, and there's some detail about them being late. One of them is late. The foreign branch is late for 104 days, but we're working with the Fed on that one. We do expect, because of our shortage, that these numbers are going to worsen. But as I've told y'all before, I'm calling it a triage. In my opinion, we may be behind technically, but we are abreast of what's going on with those institutions. On 172, an issue that's affecting the banks now with the rising rate environment, if they have a lot of fixed rate loans or fixed rate investments and in a rising rate environment, depreciation, market depreciation occurs in those bonds and investments. And there is a category called other comprehensive income that it's kind of complicated, that if you have in 2015, if you held these investments for sale, you had the option of opting in or opting out. If you opted in, you had to mark your investments to market. If you opted out, you did not have to. Everybody opted out that had these investments in held for sale, but you still have to report in your call report what that is. And so we have, recently, we have a few banks, because of the depreciation, market depreciation in the bond account, our investment account, that they have negative equity. And but that's GAAP, if you will, but RAP says you add that depreciation back. So when you add it back, the banks are there. The intent for those banks, even though they're in held for sale, basically are to hold those on for investment until maturity. So the thought is they don't have to mark them down. Somewhat concerned about this. This is a phenomenon that's going on nationally. If the rates continue to go up, if we could have more banks in this category. But we don't think that if they play a proper liquidity, it can continue to meet the demands of their customers as rates rise. If they continue to meet their customers' demand, we don't think this is going to be a major problem, but it's something we're certainly having to monitor. I hope that makes sense. COVID-19, I'm going to tell you, this is the last time we're going to record that. So we'll move on from that.
Can I ask a question about the job posting in Dallas? Is that the two applicants are internal? Do you have any external applicants for that position?
We did post it externally, but we did not receive any, and the two are internal.
Okay, thank you.
Talking about what's going on, I think Ernest mentioned the next week on Thursday, the House Pension Investment and Financial Services Committee, PIFS, is having a hearing. One is on the one that I've been asked to testify on is on digital assets. And so obviously this is crypto, this is everything digital assets, and that's an interim charge. And we will be providing testimony in that regard next week. Beginning on page 173 would be the applications that we have. Mark Largent in the audience is the Director of Corporate Activities. On page 174, I will say that the filings basically are consistent. Significant filings in the middle of the page is Liberty National Bank in Liberty, Texas has applied to convert about $430 billion. And Pinnacle Bank in Fort Worth is a filing to acquire the Crockett National Bank. And then actual activity of the National Bank of Texas at Fort Worth has converted to our charter, so that's a plus one. The Bank of Houston has converted in Houston, obviously, has converted to our charter, so that's a plus one. The United Bank of El Paso, Del Norte, in El Paso has merged with a national bank in New Mexico, so that's a minus one. And then our First State Bank in Rice has merged into the National Bank of Kemp. So that is a minus one. So number count, that's a net neutral. And then I will say that we did receive this week another application for converting from a national to state charter. It's the Worthington National Bank in Fort Worth, about a $540 million. So I will say that the conversions continue. On 176 would be our non-depository activities, and in my analysis of this, it basically shows that things are basically the same. Down at the bottom, you have somewhat of a quality ratings, and those metrics indicate that there's starting to change. On 177, we're talking about examination activities. First bullet point there. I still want to reiterate that each state has, on the money service businesses, each state has their own regulation. And so there's 50 state plus various other territories that regulate money service businesses. We try to work with other states when we're doing examinations. That's a priority of ours. Whether we could join together, six or seven states join together to do the exam, it becomes accepted by another state and vice versa, possibly other states could do the exam, and if we will accept it for one of ours. So it's a cooperative agreement that we're working on. Down at the bottom, under division activities, Jesse Facillo in the audience, our director of non-depository, is on the MTRA board, Money Transmitter Regulators Association. He's also on the MMET task force, which I chair, and we're doing quite a bit to try to coordinate supervisory activities at the state level, and a lot of things going on in order to try to do that. I will mention that there's also been a model law that we've been working on for about 6 years now for money transmission that puts everybody on the same page if adopted by all the states, and we will be working with the legislature hopefully to get that adopted. It's already been adopted in 2 states. On page 179, you have all of our acting postings, and we talked about in the budget process about where we are. On the FE1, or the new examiners, we don't have any postings for that. This is where we hope that when we get our training up to speed, so to speak, that we'll be able to put out some postings in the October timeframe. The 180 are authorized, it's at 202, but we've got about 34 vacancies. And then on 181 would be our turnover. So we've had 24 resignations in the all employee level. I think that's around 12%, depending on what number you want to use. And then 17 financial examiners have resigned. The retirement is at 5. We've had 6 except positions in private industry. So.
Just a quick question. When you're recruiting off the college campuses, is it, and this is for all three, is it finance, accounting majors? What do you look for? General business? Is that the core group?
Indeed.
Yes. For your comment, we actively recruit. In fact, several of us are involved in the schools and banking schools like Sam Houston, right. A&M. Several banking schools have started, and Wendy's involved in one. And we have always had an active position there, but we are doubling down and trying to get that. We have interns. Like we just had one intern that we've offered. He's accepted employment on. So you're right. It really, really helps them, and it helps us. And so we're working with the heads of those schools to try to have a better relationship than we've had in the past. So on 183 starts the complaint area. I will say that it's all consistent. It's all the kind of normal activity that we've always seen. Nothing abnormal, in my opinion, unless y'all have any questions. And on page 188 is kind of a recap of those totals. So we're nearly finished the year, so we're at over 1,000 that we've dealt with in some form or fashion. This 190 tells you again of the people that observe the webcast of our Finance Commission. We are a little over 40, I believe. So we'll have to do something to have commercials or
get sponsorship up that number.
So that is the report for the department. Really a lot of activity. Unless y'all have any questions, I'd like to ask Deputy General Counsel Marcus Adams to come up and give the legal division update.
Good morning. It's still morning. Marcus Adams, Department of Banking. We are on page 191 of your packet. As you can see, we have a number of pending matters. From what is in the packet, there are no updates on those matters, but I'm happy to answer any questions you may have on them. Otherwise, on the following page, under our public information request, there is a comment that one request for AG opinion is pending. That request or that opinion has finally been received from the Attorney General, and we are proceeding with responding to the requester appropriately. Other than that, that is all we have for the legal division, unless you have any other questions.
Questions, members?
Thank you for that long report. So, Mr. Chairman, that concludes the Department of Banking.
Thank you so much. Members, anything else for our final thoughts for the day? One thing I'd like for you to do is to consider looking, it's been posted on the website, our future meeting dates coming up for next year, 23. That is a legislative session. Hotel rooms are somewhat at a premium, so if you can start looking at those. I know when I looked out, I think in the summer meetings, some of those room rates, as Sharon and I were talking about, get up to be $600-$700 for a Hampton Inn downtown. So I don't know what's going on, but if we need to adjust our schedule based on availability of rooms, we need to do that as soon as we can. So if I'm looking at it in a different spectrum, maybe you can see it too. Let us know as quickly as possible if we need to start looking ahead. But I know the February meeting and April meeting, those dates were somewhat reasonable still on hotel rates for those of us that are looking for those.
So what action do you want us to take?
Just let us know if you have any.
When trying to book the room.
Yes, if it's difficult for the room rates to stay within that manageable number that we'd like to stay
February within. February and April, right?
No, February and April I think are okay, but going forward. But just go ahead and start looking since those dates have all been posted out there. I want to welcome the public and being here today. Thank you, Sarah, for always joining us. And so with nothing else, at this time, the commission will conclude. It is 11:34 a.m. Thank you so much for being here.